British Premier League football team Tottenham Hotspurs have come under fire ahead of a pre-season friendly match. The fixture, pitting Tottenham against Italian side AS Roma, scheduled in Haifa on July the 30th, has been condemned as an attempt to normalise crimes against Palestinians by critics.
The fans especially, amongst whom are many people of Muslim background or of ethnic minorities, they will be big supporters of the Palestinians, but the team going out there is a slap in the face for them.
The London-based Human Rights Commission launched a letter campaign encouraging supporters to write to Tottenham and demand the club cancel the controversial fixture. Elsewhere, pro-Palestine supporters condemned the fixture online.
We have an epidemic of Russophobia in this country and across the whole of the West, but there is no similar attempt to hold Israel to account for its crimes. 74 years since Israel was created out of the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, people who are still refugees with no home to go to.
Israel has been recognised by Amnesty International as an apartheid regime. Their crimes have been well documented for many years. Just days prior to Tottenham announcing the fixture, international outrage was sparked over the slaying of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhileh. Tottenham have so far not commented on any of the criticism, but they did announce last May that they were delighted with their planned tour of Israel. This suggests that perhaps Tottenham Hotspurs is not as concerned about human rights abuses as perhaps they should be. Robert Carter, London.
As hundreds of thousands of Muslims embark upon a pilgrimage to the Holy Kaaba in Mecca, they must enter a particular state of purification and sanctity known as the Ihram. In Arabic, Ihram means prohibition and a state of holiness.
Ihram and Miqat are like a runway for planes. If one wants to ascend, he'd better use this runway. You can't do it from anywhere else.
Ihram is an obligatory prerequisite to Hajj. Muslims stop at a designated station to perform the rituals associated with wearing ihram. The stations of Miqat are the five prescribed places for ihram, located at different directional corners from the holy city of Mecca, Saudi Arabia. Pilgrims perform ablution and cleanse their bodies. Then they wear ihram and make niyat, the intention of performing hajj. Men are required to wear two pieces of white cloth that are unadorned and plain. Women are not required to conform to a specific dress code, but have to dress modestly. It is crucial to ensure that the clothes are neat and tidy.
In addition to its facade, Hajj has an essence. We must find out the essence of the act of wearing ihram. This attire signifies the removal of any impurity or unclean aspect from our body and soul.
We wear ihram to abstain from sins we have committed in the past and get closer to God. After wearing ihram, Muslims are prohibited from a number of acts.
Ihram also resembles the shroud used to wrap dead bodies before they are buried. Therefore, it's a reminder of how death comes unannounced and does not discriminate between anyone.
There are different stages in Hajj that are like wake-up calls for us in our lives. Ihram reminds us of the afterlife and that our existence would not perish after death.
After cleansing their bodies and wearing ihram, Muslims get ready for the journey to the holy city of Mecca and they will visit Kaaba. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
A perfect storm is brewing for Italy's economy. Just as the country was beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel after getting badly hurt during the pandemic, a combination of more unexpected shocks is threatening its stability. The energy crunch due to the Ukraine crisis, the subsequent energy price spikes and rising interest rates are threatening to put Italy's economy on the ropes.
Confidence has diminished considerably in Italy, with consumers and companies seeing a less positive future. Households are increasingly feeling the brunt of the inflation that has risen to nearly 7%, the highest level in over two decades.
Analysts are saying that Italy's economy could contract further if Russia, after reducing gas supply by 40%, decides to stop the flow of gas altogether. A total halt in supply could trigger company shutdowns and layoffs. Numerous protests have been staged across the country over the past weeks amidst growing skepticism toward the government. As the European Central Bank is expected to adopt higher interest rates to counter the Eurozone's growing inflation, conditions of living are expected to worsen in Italy and across the old continent. Many fear this deteriorating scenario is likely to lead to a hot autumn of protests. Max Civili, Rome.
The Iranian city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province is the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which became the target of weapons of mass destruction in the world. In June 1987, Iraqi warplanes dropped mustard gas bombs on Sardasht in two separate bombing runs on four residential areas. The gas attacks occurred during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, when Iraq frequently used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and soldiers. According to official reports, out of 12,000 inhabitants of Sardasht, over 8,000 were chemically wounded, while 130 people died of the mustard gas attack.
After 3 decades, the city of Sardasht is still reeling from the consequences of Iraq's chemical bombardment, since many of the survivors still have to live with the long-term respiratory and even psychological effects of inhaling mustard gas used in the attack.
In April 2004, the Tehran Public Court found the government of the United States liable for the attacks through its support for the regime of Saddam Hussein. The U.S. government was ordered to pay $600 million in compensation to the victims.
The chemical attack survivors fell victim to some Western government's inhumane policies. When Western companies gave Saddam's regime chemical materials and technology for production of chemical weapons, with the representatives of their government in the UN Security Council remaining silent, turning a blind eye to Saddam's chemical crimes and letting him continue using chemical weapons against combatants and civilians. The U.S. and its allies are the main perpetrator of this heinous crime.
Saddam's regime used chemical weapons against Iranian forces and civilians more than 300 times during the 8-year war, leading to the injury of more than 100,000 people, including thousands of civilians. Over 400 Western companies equipped Saddam with chemical and biological weapons. According to available documents, most of these companies belonged to Germany, Britain, and France.
Despite the passage of 35 years from the Sardasht chemical bombings, still the families of victims urged the international community to bring the main perpetrators of the crimes to justice. But their call seemed to have fallen on deaf ears so far. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
It was the announcement years in the making. An opportunity for Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon to lay out her party's vision for a Scotland free of Westminster control.
Presiding Officer, now is the time, at this critical moment in history, to debate and decide the future of our country. Now is the time to get Scotland on the right path, the path chosen by those who live here. Now is the time for independence.
For long-time pro-independence campaigners, the news was warmly greeted.
I think many people in Scotland are going to be very pleased. I mean, we have to put up with a Boris Johnson government. Many things, of course, are devolved to the Scottish government, but many are not. And therefore, we still have inflicted on us a government we never voted for, a Conservative government. We don't vote Conservative, we get Conservative governments. And Boris Johnson is regarded as being a complete Etonian liability by people in Scotland. We want to escape.
Scots were promised a once-in-a-generation opportunity to vote for independence back in 2014, where the Yes movement narrowly missed out by 55.3% to 44.7%. Now, recent polls put the matter much more equally balanced, with an almost 50-50 split.
Boris Johnson will not want to go down in history as the Conservative leader who spearheaded the breakup of the Union. So Westminster will be doing all that it can to keep Scotland within the fold. But with such stark differences emerging between the devolved administration in London, well, the task of keeping the Union intact is becoming more difficult than ever. The response from London has been a familiar one, simply saying now is not the right time for a vote. But some ministers have been less diplomatic.
They lost the referendum, and instead of then saying, OK, hands up, let's try and see if there's a better way, let's try and better the people of Scotland's experience with public services, she's just banged on the same one-trick pony.
Recent political events across the Union have presented a growing headache for the Conservatives, with unionists across the region losing ground. Aside from the legal battles ahead, the SNP also has to win the domestic argument. With a tough road ahead, the SNP says the Scottish people should have the right to determine their own future, a move London will attempt to thwart at every stage. Amina Taylor, London.
Afghan people affected by the earthquake in southeastern Afghanistan are grappling with dire situations. Hundreds of families are living in the open, out of fear that there may be further tremors.
For the sake of God, please help us survive this catastrophe. The earthquake has devastated our houses and livelihoods. We live outdoors. During the night, it rains very heavily. I'm afraid these harsh conditions will further harm my only surviving family members. In addition, we don't have enough food and cash.
In the meantime, the affected people in Paktika and Khost provinces say that the provided aid is not sufficient.
We thank the Afghan government and charities for assisting us with humanitarian aid, but they are not sufficient as thousands of our people in several districts have been affected by the deadly earthquake. There are a lot of children who are awaiting food and wounded people who are in dire need of medication. We ask them to scale up their assistance to our people, especially food, drinking water, and tents.
The Afghan health minister, in a press conference in Kabul on Monday, warned that the survivors of the earthquake are at risk of diseases, including mental problems.
This is very true that affected people are also exposed to getting sick. Some are getting mental or psychological illnesses because they have lost everything, including their loved ones. Some people, especially children, are at risk of malnourishment and other diseases. I call on the international community to help us stave off the disaster and create a safe situation for them to live on.
So far, the United Nations and several neighboring countries have rushed aid to the devastated areas, but helping thousands of victims remains a challenge for the foreign countries due to the U.S. restrictions imposed on the country following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan. Afghanistan has been facing multiple humanitarian crises in the past decades. The recent earthquake is a reminder that the war-torn country should not be forgotten by the global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's new parliament has been inaugurated, and many expect the next 5 years will be turbulent. President Emmanuel Macron was reprimanded at the ballot box, losing his absolute majority. He then failed to cobble together a coalition, leaving France with a so-called hung parliament. Each different bill will now have to find its own majority to become enacted, although since 2012, French presidents have often resorted to executive decrees to pass unpopular, austerity-minded legislation. Many also speculate that if Parliament doesn't work in his favor, that Macron could call for new elections in maybe a matter of months.
He's not going to be able to do anything to make any reform because it's going to be completely blocked between the extreme right wing and the Mélenchon team, which are completely opposite. And so I believe that not much is going to happen during the next 5 years, which will give rise to, you know, more extreme positions in the future.
The far-right national rally, led by Marine Le Pen, won a record 15% of seats. Islamophobia has already been obvious in France's judicial and presidential branches, and now it's widely present in their legislative branch.
Je pense que
We now have an assembly which better represents the range of public opinion. The president will stay in his assigned role of a sort of republican monarch. We'll see more debate, and that might produce more reforms.
A clear improvement is an increased number of working-class legislators, thanks to the NUPES leftist coalition, but even more so because of the national rally. Still, just 6% of parliamentarians are from the working class. Yael Braun-Pivet was elected speaker, the first woman to hold the post, and another relatively unknown politician from Macron's party. France is the second-to-last country in the European Union to have a woman head a House of Parliament. By denying Macron a majority, French Parliament is poised to play a bigger role than at any time in the 21st century. However, they face an executive branch which has repeatedly found ways to either sideline or bypass them. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The UK is not a significant haven for refugees. The country holds 1% of the world's total population and accepts fewer than 0.1% of the world's refugees each year. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by David Renton, writer. This article is published under the heading Boris Johnson dodged a COVID reckoning. Now he's doubling down on deportations. Here's the story. After weeks in which commentators had been predicting UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's removal from office for breaking the UK's own COVID-era public health laws, the impression now is that he has survived for the time being. The news that Johnson will not face any further fines after his staff were issued with 126 fixed penalty notices for COVID-19 breaches has been widely interpreted as proof of the Prime Minister's talent for survival. As one commentator put it, the Prime Minister has dodged a Partygate reckoning. As recently as this January, it had seemed that the Conservative government might be doomed. The sense now is that Johnson has escaped, albeit with weakened authority. In the UK's political system, prime ministers are not directly elected, but hold office only indirectly through the support of a majority of their own members of parliament. Several of recent prime ministers, including Margaret Thatcher, Tony Blair and Theresa May, were removed from office not because they had lost an election, but because elections were looming and their own MPs expected them to lose. Prime Minister Johnson's support remains, from this perspective, very thin. The Conservatives have not led in any poll since December last year, with 148 national polls since then predicting losses for their party at the next general election. Something then, it follows, will have to change. Either the opposition Labour Party's lead will shrink and Johnson will be able to convert his weak administration into a durable regime, or Labour's lead will grow to the point where the prospect of the Conservatives' defeat at the next election seems so likely that his own MPs topple him. If the opposition's present poll advantage persists, we could see Johnson's regime end in a palace coup. The UK Prime Minister appears to believe that his government can boost its popularity with a new plan announced last month to deport refugees arriving in Britain for processing overseas. The plan is that refugees will be deported to Central Africa, forced to claim asylum there, and if successful, forcibly relocated not to Britain but to Rwanda. Johnson seems to believe that this flagship policy will bolster his support with wavering voters. The UK is not a significant haven for refugees. The country holds 1% of the world's total population and accepts fewer than 0.1% of the world's refugees each year. By effectively abandoning the UN Refugee Convention, the UK proposes to send a signal to the rest of the world that refugees can be ignored. The convention was signed in 1951. It was one of the series of international treaties signed with a common intention of protecting the world from a return to fascism. Its abandonment by the UK would be a small but ominously significant step in the global drift to authoritarianism. At the press conference where he announced the Rwanda plan, Boris Johnson suggested that it would face legal challenge from his opponents. "I know that this system will not take effect overnight," he said, adding, "We have such a formidable army of potentially motivated lawyers who for years have made it their business to thwart removals and frustrate the government. Component governments do not spend their time begging hostile lawyers to take them to court, nor do they predict, as Johnson seemed to do, that these lawyers will win." So why was the Prime Minister seemingly pleading with his opponents to sue him? And what are his opponents thinking by saying that they will indeed take this scheme to the court? To understand both side thinking, it is useful to look at the 2019 general election and the events which immediately preceded it. On August 28 that year, the government had announced that it was proroguing Parliament, seemingly in order to force through a settlement of the country's long-standing Brexit crisis without a vote. 4 weeks later, Supreme Court ruled that that measure has been unlawful. This was the greatest constitutional crisis Britain had seen in 300 years, with ministers insisting that according to the country's unwritten constitution, they could govern so long as they had the Queen's approval. Unlike the US, the UK does not have a single constitutional document. They do have laws of very great or constitutional significance. However, they are dispersed over several different documents, and there is no single agreed document setting out which of laws have this unique importance. By rejecting the doctrine that ministers could govern with the support of the crown against the wishes of parliament, the Supreme Court became the savior of the separation of powers in the UK political system and doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty. But even though the 11 Supreme Court justices ruling unanimously against prorogation, the British public has had other ideas. Just 3 months after the Supreme Court's ruling, the Conservatives increased their seats by 48 votes, converting what had been a narrow minority government into a secure majority one. To make matters worse, a significant portion of the seats newly won by the Conservatives were Rust Belt towns, which had been taken for granted as Labour seats, representing places such as Redcar, never previously won by the Conservatives, Relay in Manchester, last lost by Labour in 1922. The most common explanation for Johnson's victory was that working-class voters had been attracted to a populist candidate promising to break all the rules. It is this story which Johnson likes to tell, and in that context, we can see why he is so willing to risk international criticism and play the role of a mid-Atlantic Donald Trump. Why should Johnson care if democracy suffers so long as he continues to govern? Johnson seems to see the prospect of a defeat in the courts over the Rwanda scheme as his opportunity to rerun the battles that brought about his victory in 2019. However, for his liberal critics, the context is more favorable now than 3 years ago. Johnson has been prime minister all this time. It is harder for him to pose as an outsider. Inflation in the UK is at 9%, the highest it has been in 40 years. Rising food and electricity prices are taking money out of the pockets of key groups of Conservative voters, including those who live on savings and the elderly. Depressingly, the opposition Labour Party too often presents the issue as one of competence. As if what is wrong with the proposal of deporting refugees to Rwanda is that the government has gone about this scheme in a shambolic fashion, failing to obtain any guarantees from Rwanda and at excessive cost. This reflects Labour's self-presentation as a party with no different politics than the Conservatives, only a much greater belief in the rules. Yet the Conservatives are turning on refugees at the very moment that more British people are opening their homes to refugees than ever before. Since the start of the crisis in Eastern Europe, more than 50,000 people have sought temporary refuge in the UK. An official website through which British people could register to offer their homes to new arrivals crashed after people volunteered their assistance at the rate of 10,000 offers an hour. This instinct of generosity, the belief of ordinary voters that refugees should be welcomed, is the force which could yet topple Johnson.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's called the New Force Model by NATO, in which it says it is a new strategic concept, one that describes Russia as the most significant and direct threat to allies' security and stability. Now we ask, what is so new about that? Meanwhile, Russia has reacted and has accused the U.S.-led NATO of aggressive containment of Russia. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll review the NATO summit's communique, which also includes how it has described China of being a threat to the world order.
Leaders of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization gathered for their annual summit in the Spanish capital, Madrid. As expected, this year's summit turned into an anti-Russia agenda in the wake of growing tensions between Moscow and the West over the Ukraine war that began in February.
President Putin's war against Ukraine has shattered peace in Europe and has created the biggest security crisis in Europe since the Second World War.
The Western Military Alliance also pledged to ramp up military support for Ukraine.
And today, leaders agreed to strengthen our support by agreeing a comprehensive assistance package for Ukraine. This includes equipment to counter mines and chemical and biological threats, and hundreds of portable anti-drone systems.
Western countries, including the United States, have provided Kiev with billions of dollars worth of weapons since the war began. Russia sees it as the main factor behind prolonging the conflict.
It seems to us that the kind of line that the West has taken is absolutely counterproductive and harmful. The more they pump weapons into Ukraine, the longer this conflict will last.
Irrespective of huge military support for Ukraine, NATO's ambitious plan for expanding its membership has also driven a wedge between the alliance and Russia. However, NATO leaders have welcomed Finland and Sweden into the alliance after Turkey struck a deal with the Nordic duo to drop its objections.
Today, NATO leaders took the historic decision to invite Finland and Sweden to become members of NATO. The agreement concluded last night by Turkey, Finland and Sweden paved the way for this decision.
Russia says the two countries' accession to NATO is destabilizing.
We consider the expansion of the North Atlantic Alliance to be a purely destabilizing factor in international affairs. It does not add security either to those who are expanding it, those joining it, or to other countries that perceive the alliance as a threat.
The rift between Russia and the West has raised concerns that the ongoing war in Ukraine could escalate into a nuclear conflict, the fallout of which could deal devastating blows to the world.
Our guests joining us for this edition of The Spotlight. Daniel Kovalik, an international human rights and labor lawyer, joins us from Pittsburgh, PA. Also joining us is Kent Stone, from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, who joins us from Hamilton, Ontario. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Kent Stone, I'm going to first start with you. What do you think about the name New Force Model, which NATO describes as a new strategic blueprint in which the U.S.-led NATO is referring to Russia based on this as a direct threat to the security of the member states? And then my question to you is, what is so new about this? And even if it's true, who provoked this sentiment for Russia to become, as they perceive, a security threat?
Well, it's not new at all. As a matter of fact, when Lester B. Pearson, who was Foreign Minister of Canada, proposed the formation of NATO, before 1949, his view was to bring down socialism in the former Soviet Union, and to actually bring down the Soviet Union. So NATO has been a threat, an existential threat, to Russia for 70 years. And they, once the Soviet Union dissolved itself, rather than dissolving NATO, which was supposed to be dealing with a supposed Russian threat, NATO went on the warpath and showed its true colors. It is the aggressive military alliance led by the United States, which promptly in the 1990s went against the former Yugoslavian Federation, and attacked it, bombed it for 78 days, and destroyed it, and swallowed up its component parts. Then it went after Afghanistan, and then it went after Iraq, and then it went after Libya. So the U.S. Has NATO in its pocket as an aggressive military alliance. The U.S., when the Soviet Union dissolved itself, wanted to become the only superpower in a unipolar world, and that's what they're trying to do today in Madrid. They are saying that Russia is the enemy, and Russia does not want to be seen as its enemy.
Okay.
Okay.
You make some good points there. I'd like to, however, move on to this timeline, Daniel Kovalik, which was highlighted just a few weeks back, and that is the fact that this war passed 100 days. And that was obviously a very grim milestone in a sense. But in reality, this war has been going on now for 8 years, hasn't it? And if you want to even go further than that, we can, because Russia has been seeing NATO's eastward expansion for all this time, hasn't it? It's been provoked, whether directly by NATO and its moves, but even more so maybe by the U.S. in terms of the way that it has treated Russia in terms of sanctions, in terms of just making it and a national security threat based on the way that the U.S. sees it. So is it a surprise that Russia has acted out the way that it did? Again, I need to make a note here that we are not for war. We're not advocating war by this question. But, you know, when you push somebody so much for such a length of time, then my question to you is it a surprise that Russia has acted out?
No, and I've written about this. I mean, first of all, I've been writing about this for years, that this was a risk, that eventually Russia probably would react the way they did because of, as you say, NATO expansion that really began in earnest under William Jefferson Clinton, even after numerous promises were made by James Baker and others that NATO would not move an inch east of Germany if the Berlin Wall came down, which it did, but the U.S. and NATO never upheld their part of that bargain. And you mentioned, of course, in 2014, the coup against the government in Ukraine, which the U.S. was behind, and the U.S.-backed ultra-right-wing forces that very quickly made it clear that they wanted to ethnically cleanse the ethnic Russian population from the eastern part of Ukraine. We see the New York Times in the past week has said what a lot of us have known for a while, that the CIA has been operating in Ukraine for some time, training and giving logistical support to armed forces that target Russians in Ukraine. So really what's happened in Madrid is simply an announcement of a position of a strategy that's existed for a long time, which has been the dismantling of Russia. I think that, you know, in the light of day now, as the years have passed, we can now honestly and truthfully say that the Cold War never really ended, that the Russians fully expected it would end with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the East Bloc in 1991. But for the West, it never ended. That was not enough, that it wasn't just about communism. It was about Russia as well. And it was about China as well as potential adversaries. And now we know this. And now NATO is being very clear that their intention is to drive Russia into the ground.
Well, Kent Stone, when you take a look, I referred to a timeline there to Daniel Kovalik. When you take a look at the length of this war, the way that the U.S. has approached it in particular, And then you take a look at what has happened in this summit, where NATO felt that there needs to be a new rejuvenate this anti-Russia sentiment in a new form. It's almost like it's being reintroduced. Is there a possibility that they're doing that because they want to make sure that the threat or the perceived threat of Russia still exists among member states, led by the U.S., which is ramping up, in a sense, scaremongering, so that that remains and people or the countries don't falter from that course?
Well, it's clear to me and to people in the peace movement that what NATO is doing in Ukraine is to march NATO up to the borders of Russia, of the Russian Federation, and do to Russia what it did to the former Yugoslavia. That is to say, to defeat it militarily and then to dismember it, the better to gobble it up. It's part of the U.S. plan, with the help of its military alliance, NATO, to achieve hegemony over the entire world. After they supposedly get the defeat of Russia and the dismemberment of the Russian Federation, then they will move on to China. That's the plan. And it should be clear to everyone in the world. It's clear to us here in the peace movement, and it's clear to people who are demonstrating in Madrid today and having counter summits, and it's clear to the workers who are in Spain and Greece and other countries who are preventing supplies, military equipment for, of NATO going to Ukraine, that the NATO has, and U.S., of course, has a warlike agenda. Their plans to expand their strike force, to label Russia as an adversary, and to label China as a threat, is clearly antagonistic to our desire to have a peaceful world where all countries are their sovereignty is treated with respect. But that's not the case with NATO. When the U.S. decides that it wants to force a country to yield its energy resources, as in the case of Libya, or its strategic position in the case of Afghanistan, it unleashes NATO upon that country and creates havoc. It destroys whole countries and turns their population into refugees. And this is what we've seen over and over again in the past 30 years. And yes, the U.S. is trying to marshal its European vassals, and I say vassals because they can be herded, even though it's like herding cats. They can be herded and turned against an alleged enemy of the U.S. on the snap of its fingers, and they can even be persuaded to impose sanctions which cripple themselves rather than the supposed target. Right. There's going to be terrible results in Europe and North America as a result of the sanctions that have been leveled against Russia. And that's why we've been demonstrating this week all across Canada against NATO, demanding Canada get out of NATO, demanding that NATO disband, and that there should not be a new arms race, which is being provoked by NATO by sending all these arms into Ukraine, and to insist on countries like Canada upping its military spending to 2%. In Canada, it means a 70% increase in military spending. It's outrageous.
Well, we're looking again at what the U.S. President Joe Biden has said, Daniel Kovalik, in terms of pledging more military aid, in terms of more, things like warplanes and warships for Europe. $5 billion in U.S. aid, or maybe a little more than that, has been pledged during the Biden administration. But at the same time, we're seeing that Russia is not losing the war. Russia is going ahead with what it's doing, especially in the Donbass region. And it's interesting how NATO nor the U.S. are really even stating that Ukraine is actually being defeated. Why then is the U.S. first, then the NATO partner countries, sending more weapons and pledging more aid when Ukraine is being defeated? What does that say?
Well, we know why. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, about 6 weeks ago, I guess it was, made it very clear that the goal in Ukraine is to weaken Russia. That is to say, the U.S. will continue to support the war effort in Ukraine, regardless of whether Ukraine can win or not. They can't.
Well, tell us what you think he means when he says weaken Russia. You either weaken a country that's at war by either killing their soldiers or for that country to run out of ammunition. Which is it?
Well, I think they want to kill their soldiers. They want to continue to have U.S. or Russia send soldiers to Ukraine and be killed. And yes, they want them to use up weaponry. They want their government to spend their revenue, of course, some of which the U.S. has stolen, on weapons and soldiers instead of on the economy and building up the economy and putting money into social programs. This is exactly the strategy that the U.S. openly, or at least after the fact, admitted, Brzezinski admitted openly later, that they used against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. The goal in Afghanistan in the 80s was to draw the Soviet Union into a war that would undermine and destroy the Soviet Union. In the words of Brzezinski, he wanted to give the Soviet Union its Vietnam, referring, of course, to the U.S. war in Vietnam, which was very destructive of the United States. And that's exactly what happened. And it did, in fact, help to weaken and ultimately destroy the Soviet Union. This is exactly the same game plan. They wanted this war. They provoked this war. Even the Pope has said that probably this war was provoked by the U.S. and NATO. They wanted to do that. They wanted Russia to intervene. And they want to extend this war as long as possible to undermine and, if they could, destroy Russia. And they don't care about Ukraine or the Ukrainians. They will fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. That is what is very clear.
Well, let's see here. Let's refer Ken Stone to what the U.S. National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, has said. And let me get your reaction on this, on your reading into this. He said that Zelensky wanted to pretty much secure an advantageous position in this conflict with Russia in months. By the end of the year, it turned out was what Zelensky was referring to, rather than years. That's coming from the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan. What does that say when Jake Sullivan makes that statement, when he says in months is what Zelensky wants rather than years, which is what the U.S. has in mind?
Well, like our Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland, the U.S. Leaders have made it clear that what they want to achieve in Ukraine, as Dan Kovalik has correctly pointed out, is to defeat Russia. And Chrystia Freeland used the words vanquish Russia and defeat it. She said that. While she was donating $500 million of Canadians' taxpayers' money to Ukraine. And in addition to that, they've sent several billion dollars worth of military equipment and other kinds of funding to Ukraine. And the purpose of this is to bring about the defeat of Russia. It's the opposite. It shows that the U.S. and NATO, Canada, and all the other NATO allies have an aggressive agenda here, and they're not about to look for peace with Russia. They've encouraged Mr. Zelensky and his government to continue fighting rather than bring about de-escalation, rather than fueling the conflict with arms and funding. And now Canadian Special Forces, according to the New York Times, are in Ukraine. And we were at the minister's office in Oakville yesterday, the defense minister's office, and she doesn't deny the fact that they're there. So they're there. And so Canada is de facto at war with Russia right now because we have boots on the ground in Ukraine. It's an aggressive war. What the opposite of all this would be, As the Russians argue, there should be a mutual security system in Europe such that the security of one state doesn't impinge upon the security of others. If all the states got together and achieved a collective or a mutual security system, we could have peace. But that's not on the agenda for the U.S. and NATO. This is clearly an aggressive move, an escalation, which brings us closer to the unthinkable, as your earlier report said. It brings us closer to a nuclear confrontation between nuclear powers. And that's something that could bring about the end, that would bring about the end of human civilization. So we should think, people across the world are thinking about the danger of this, and that's why people are in the streets, because they don't want this U.S. aggressive action in Ukraine and in Madrid to strengthen NATO to bring about the end of their lives and their children's lives.
Indeed. Well, it doesn't look like that's going to happen. Daniel Kovala, Kent Stone talks about this unified security apparatus of some kind to be agreed upon, as Russia has proposed, so that there could be a mutual approach towards this conflict. But when you have Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, talk about how this war is going to end on the negotiating table, and at the same breath, he says only on the condition that Ukraine gets what it wants. I repeat, Ukraine gets what it wants, and that depends on the gains on the battlefield. How can you have a unified strategy of security when the other side is talking about what I just said?
This has never been about security. Not national security, not the security of the EU. Russia's never been a threat to the EU or to the United States. In fact, we have to be reminded that Putin was the first world leader to call George W. Bush after 9/11, offer condolences, offer help in the war on terror. Russia always wanted to work with the West. This is not about security. This is about the West's desire to create insecurity in Russia, to destroy Russia. That's what this is about. This has nothing to do with the EU protecting its own security. In fact, just the opposite. The sanctions have backfired on the EU. They are making the EU more insecure. They're going to be lucky if they can heat their homes come this winter.
Exactly. I'm going to have to jump in, unfortunately. Daniel Kovalik, we're just fresh out of time. I'm so sorry. Daniel Kovalik, the international human rights and labor lawyer. Thank you. From Pittsburgh, PA. Kent Stone, Canada, out of NATO. I see your pin. We got the message. Thank you. Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War from Hamilton, Ontario. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from